Section 32 of Emile. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Emile by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Translated by Barbara Foxley. The Creed of the Savoyard Priest, Part 7. There are moments in human life which can never be forgotten. Such is the time when Emile receives the instruction of which I have spoken. Its influence should endure all his life through. Let us try to engrave it on his memory so that it may never fade away. It is one of the faults of our age to rely too much on cold reason, as if all men were all mind. By neglecting the language of expression, we have lost the most forcible mode of speech. The spoken word is always weak, and we speak to the heart rather through the eyes than the ears. In our attempt to appeal to reason only, we have reduced our precepts to words. We have not embodied them indeed. Mere reason is not active. Occasionally she restrains, more rarely she stimulates, but she never does any great thing. Small minds have a mania for reasoning. Strong souls speak a very different language, and it is by this language that men are persuaded and driven to action. I observe that in modern times men only get a hold of others by force or self-interest, while the ancients did more by persuasion, by the affections of the heart, because they did not neglect the language of symbolic expression. All agreements were drawn up solemnly, so that they might be more inviolable. Before the reign of force, the gods were the judges of mankind. In their presence, individuals made their treaties and alliances, and pledged themselves to perform their promises. The face of the earth was the book in which the archives were preserved. The leaves of this book were rocks, trees, piles of stones, made sacred by these transactions, and regarded with reverence by barbarous men, and these pages were always open before their eyes. The well of the oath, the well of the living and seeing one, the ancient oak of Mamre, the stones of witness, such were the simple but stately monuments of the sanctity of contracts. None dared to lay a sacrilegious hand on these monuments, and man's faith was more secure under the warrant of these dumb witnesses than it is today upon all the rigor of the law. In government, the people are overawed by the pomp and splendor of royal power. The symbols of greatness, a throne, a scepter, a purple robe, a crown, a fillet, these were sacred in their sight. These symbols and the respect which they inspired led them to reverence the venerable man whom they beheld adorned with them. Without soldiers and without threats, he spoke and was obeyed. Footnote: The Roman Catholic clergy have very wisely retained these symbols, and certain republics, such as Venice, have followed their example. Thus the Venetian government, despite the falling condition of the state, still enjoys, under the trappings of its former greatness, all the affection, all the reverence of the people, and next to the Pope in his triple crown, there is perhaps no king, no potentate, no person in the world so much respected as the Doge of Venice. He has no power, no authority, but he is rendered sacred by his pomp, and he wears beneath his ducal coronet a woman's flowing locks. That ceremony of the Bucentaurius, which stirs the laughter of fools, stirs the Venetian populace to shed its life-blood for the maintenance of this tyrannical government. End footnote. In our own day, men profess to do away with these symbols. What are the consequences of this contempt? The kingly majesty makes no impression on all hearts. Kings can only gain obedience by the help of troops, and the respect of their subjects is based only on the fear of punishment. Kings are spared the trouble of wearing their crowns, and our nobles escape from the outward signs of their station, but they must have 100,000 men at their command, if their orders are to be obeyed. Though this may seem a finer thing, it is easy to see that in the long run they will gain nothing. It is amazing what the ancients accomplished with the aid of eloquence. But this eloquence did not merely consist in fine speeches carefully prepared. It was most effective when the orator was least. The most startling speeches were expressed not in words but in signs. They were not uttered but shown. A thing beheld by the eyes kindles the imagination, stirs the curiosity, and keeps the mind on the alert for what we are about to say, and often enough the thing tells the whole story. Thrasybulus and Tarquin cutting off the heads of poppies, Alexander placing his seal on the lips of his favorite, Diogenes marching before Zeno, do not these speak more plainly than if they had uttered long orations? What flow of words could have expressed the ideas as clearly? Darius, in the course of the Scythian war, received from the kings of the Scythians a bird, a frog, a mouse, and 5 arrows. The ambassador deposited his gift and retired without a word. In our day he would have been taken for a madman. This terrible speech was understood, and Darius withdrew to his own country with what speed he could. Substitute a letter for these symbols, and the more threatening it was, the less terror it would inspire. It would have been merely a piece of bluff, to which Darius would have paid no attention. What heed the Romans gave to the language of signs? Different ages and different ranks had their appropriate garments, toga, tunic, patrician robes, fringes and borders, seats of honor, lictors, rods and axes, crowns of gold, crowns of leaves, crowns of flowers, ovations, triumphs. Everything had its pomp, its observances, its ceremonial, and all these spoke to the heart of the citizen. The state regarded it as a matter of importance that the populace should assemble in one place rather than another, that they should or should not behold the capital, that they should or should not turn towards the Senate, that this day or that should be chosen for their deliberations. The accused wore a special dress, so did the candidates for election. Warriors did not boast of their exploits, they showed their scars. I can fancy one of our orators at the death of Caesar exhausting all the commonplaces of rhetoric to give a pathetic description of his wounds, his blood, his dead body. Antony was an orator, but he said none of this. He showed the murdered Caesar. What rhetoric was this? But this digression, like many others, is drawing me unawares away from my subject, and my digressions are too frequent to be borne with patience. I therefore return to the point. Do not reason coldly with youth. Clothe your reason with a body, if you would make it felt. Let the mind speak the language of the heart, that it may be understood. I say again, our opinions, not our actions, may be influenced by cold argument. They set us thinking, not doing. They show us what we ought to think, not what we ought to do. If this is true of men, it is all the truer of young people, who are still enwrapped in their senses and cannot think otherwise than they imagine. Even after the preparations of which I have spoken, I shall take good care not to go all of a sudden to Emile's room and preach a long and heavy sermon on the subject in which he is to be instructed. I shall begin by rousing his imagination. I shall choose the time, place and surroundings most favorable to the impression I wish to make. I shall, so to speak, summon all nature as witness to our conversations. I shall call upon the eternal God, the creator of nature, to bear witness to the truth of what I say. He shall judge between Emile and myself. I will make the rocks, the woods, the mountains round about us, the monuments of his promises and mine. Eyes, voice, and gesture will show the enthusiasm I desire to inspire. Then I will speak, and he will listen, and his emotion will be stirred by my own. The more impressed I am by the sanctity of my duties, the more sacred he will regard his own. I will enforce the voice of reason with images and figures. I will not give him long-winded speeches or cold precepts, but my overflowing feelings will break their bounds. My reason shall be grave and serious, but my heart cannot speak too warmly. Then, when I have shown him all that I have done for him, I will show him how he is made for me. He will see in my tender affection the cause of all my care. How great shall I surprise and disturb him when I change my tone? Instead of shriveling up his soul by always talking of his own interests, I shall henceforth speak of my own. He will be more deeply touched by this. I will kindle in his young heart all the sentiments of affection, generosity, and gratitude which I have already called into being, and it will indeed be sweet to watch their growth. I will press him to my bosom and weep over him in my emotion. I will say to him, "You are my wealth, my child, my handiwork. My happiness is bound up in yours. If you frustrate my hopes, you rob me of 20 years of my life, and you bring my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave." This is the way to gain a hearing, and to impress what is said upon the heart and memory of the young man. Hitherto I have tried to give examples of the way in which a tutor should instruct his pupil in cases of difficulty. I have tried to do so in this instance, but after many attempts I have abandoned the task, convinced that the French language is too artificial to permit in print the plainness of speech required for the first lessons in certain subjects. They say French is more chaste than other languages. For my own part, I think it more obscene, for it seems to me that the purity of a language does not consist in avoiding coarse expressions, but in having none. Indeed, if we are to avoid them, they must be in our thoughts, and there is no language in which it is so difficult to speak with purity on every subject than French. The reader is always quicker to detect than the author to avoid a gross meaning, and he is shocked and startled by everything. How can what is heard by impure ears avoid coarseness? On the other hand, a nation whose morals are pure has fit terms for everything, and these terms are always right because they are rightly used. One could not imagine more modest language than that of the Bible, just because of its plainness of speech. The same things translated into French would become immodest. What I ought to say to Emile will sound pure and honorable to him, but to make the same impression in print would demand a like purity of heart in the reader. I should even think that reflections on true purity of speech and the sham delicacy of vice might find a useful place in the conversations as to morality to which this subject brings us. For when he learns the language of plain-spoken goodness, he must also learn the language of decency, and he must know why the two are so different. However this may be, I maintain that if instead of the empty precepts which are prematurely dinned into the ears of children, only to be scoffed at when the time comes when they might prove useful, if instead of this we bide our time, if we prepare the way for a hearing, if we then show him the laws of nature in all their truth, if we show him the sanction of these laws in the physical and moral evils which overtake those who neglect them, if while we speak to him of this great mystery of generation, we join the idea of the pleasure which the author of nature has given to this act the idea of the exclusive affection which makes it delightful, the idea of the duties of faithfulness and modesty which surround it, and redouble its charm while fulfilling its purpose. If we paint to him marriage, not only as the sweetest form of society, but also as the most sacred and inviolable of contracts, if we tell him plainly all the reasons which lead men to respect this sacred bond, and to pour hatred and curses upon him who dares to dishonor it, if we give him a true and terrible picture of the horrors of debauch, of its stupid brutality, of the downward road by which a first act of misconduct leads from bad to worse, and at last drags the sinner to his ruin. If, I say, we give him proofs that on a desire for chastity depends health, strength, courage, virtue, love itself, and all that is truly good for man, I maintain that this chastity will be so dear and so desirable in his eyes that his mind will be ready to receive our teaching as to the way to preserve it. For so long as we are chaste, we respect chastity. It is only when we have lost this virtue that we scorn it. It is not true that the inclination to evil is beyond our control, and that we cannot overcome it until we have acquired the habit of yielding to it. Aurelius Victor says that many men were mad enough to purchase a night with Cleopatra at the price of their life, and this is not incredible in the madness of passion. But let us suppose that the maddest of men, the man who has his senses least under control, let him see the preparations for his death, let him realize that he will certainly die in torment a quarter of an hour later. Not only would that man, from that time forward, become able to resist temptation, he would even find it easy to do so. The terrible picture with which they are associated will soon distract his attention from these temptations, and when they are continually put aside, they will cease to recur. The sole cause of our weakness is the feebleness of our will, and we have always strength to perform what we strongly desire. Volenti nihil difficile. Oh, if only we hated vice as much as we love life, we should abstain as easily from a pleasant sin as from a deadly poison in a delicious dish. How is it that you fail to perceive that if all the lessons given to a young man on this subject have no effect, it is because they are not adapted to his age, and that at every age reason must be presented in a shape which will win his affection? Speak seriously to him if required, but let what you say to him always have a charm which will compel him to listen. Do not coldly oppose his wishes, do not stifle his imagination, but direct it, lest it should bring forth monsters. Speak to him of love, of women, of pleasure. Let him find in your conversation a charm which delights his youthful heart. Spare no pains to make yourself his confidant. Under this name alone will you really be his master. Then you need not fear he will find your conversation tedious. He will make you talk more than you desire. If I have managed to take all the requisite precautions in accordance with these maxims, and have said the right things to Emile at the age he has now reached, I am quite convinced that he will come of his own accord to the point to which I would lead him, and will eagerly confide himself to my care. When he sees the dangers by which he is surrounded, he will say to me with all the warmth of youth, "Oh, my friend, my protector, my master, resume the authority you desire to lay aside at the very time when I most need it. Hitherto my weakness has given you this power. I now place it in your hands of my own free will, and it will be all the more sacred in my eyes. Protect me from all the foes which are attacking me, and above all from the traitors within the citadel. Watch over your work, that it may still be worthy of you. I mean to obey your laws. I shall ever do so. That is my steadfast purpose. If I ever disobey you, it will be against my will. Make me free by guarding me against the passions which do me violence. Do not let me become their slave. Compel me to be my own master and to obey, not my senses, but my reason." When you have led your pupil so far, and it will be your own fault if you fail to do so, beware of taking him too readily at his word, lest your rule should seem too strict to him, and lest he should think he has a right to escape from it by accusing you of taking him by surprise. This is the time for reserve and seriousness, and this attitude will have all the more effect upon him, seeing that it is the first time you have adopted it towards him. You will say to him, therefore, "Young man, you readily make promises which are hard to keep. You must understand what it means before you have a right to make them. You do not know how your fellows are drawn by their passions into the whirlpool of vice masquerading as pleasure. You are honorable, I know. You will never break your word. But how often will you repent of having given it? How often will you curse your friend when, in order to guard you from the ills which threaten you, he finds himself compelled to do violence to your heart, like Ulysses, who, hearing the song of the sirens, cried aloud to his rowers to unbind him. You will break your chains at the call of pleasure, and you will importune me with your lamentations. You will reproach me as a tyrant when I have your welfare most at heart. When I am trying to make you happy, I shall incur your hatred. Oh, Emile, I can never bear to be hateful in your eyes. This is too heavy a price to pay even for your happiness. My dear young man, do you not see that when you undertake to obey me, you compel me to promise to be your guide, to forget myself in my devotion to you, to refuse to listen to your murmurs and complaints, to wage unceasing war against your wishes and my own? Before we either of us undertake such a task, let us count our resources. Take your time, give me time to consider, and be sure that the slower we are to promise, the more faithfully will our promises be kept. You may be sure that the more difficulty he finds in getting your promise, the easier you will find it to carry out. The young man must learn that he is promising a great deal, and that you are promising still more. When the time is come, when he has, so to say, signed the contract, then change your tone, and make your rule as gentle as you said it would be severe. Say to him, "My young friend, it is experience that you lack, but I have taken care that you do not lack reason. You are ready to see the motives of my conduct in every respect. To do this you need only wait till you are free from excitement. Always obey me first, and then ask the reasons for my commands. I am always ready to give my reasons so soon as you are ready to listen to them, and I shall never be afraid to make you the judge between us. You promise to follow my teaching, and I promise only to use your obedience to make you the happiest of men. For proof of this, I have the life you have lived hitherto. Show me anyone of your age who has led as happy a life as yours, and I promise you nothing more. When my authority is firmly established, my first care will be to avoid the necessity of using it. I shall spare no pains to become more and more firmly established in his confidence, to make myself the confidant of his heart and the arbiter of his pleasures. Far from combating his youthful tastes, I shall consult them that I may be their master. I will look at things from his point of view that I may be his guide. I will not seek a remote, distant good at the cost of his present happiness. I would always have him happy, always, if that may be. Those who desire to guide young people rightly and to preserve them from the snares of sense give them a disgust for love, and would willingly make the very thought of it a crime, as if love were for the old. All these mistaken lessons have no effect. The heart gives the lie to them. The young man, guided by a surer instinct, laughs to himself over the gloomy maxims which he pretends to accept, and only awaits the chance of disregarding them. All that is contrary to his nature. By following the opposite course, I reach the same end more safely. I am not afraid to encourage in him the tender feeling for which he is so eager. I shall paint it as the supreme joy of life, as indeed it is, when I picture it to him. I desire that he shall give himself up to it, by making him feel the charm which the union of hearts adds to the delights of senses. I shall inspire him with a disgust for debauchery. I shall make him a lover and a good man. How narrow-minded to see nothing in the rising desires of a young heart but obstacles to the teaching of reason. In my eyes, these are the right means to make him obedient to that very teaching. Only through passion can we gain the mastery over passions. Their tyranny must be controlled by their legitimate power, and nature herself must furnish us with the means to control her. Emile is not made to live alone. He is a member of society, and must fulfill his duties as such. He is made to live among his fellow men, and he must get to know them. He knows mankind in general. He has still to learn to know individual men. He knows what goes on in the world. He has now to learn how men live in the world. It is time to show him the front of that vast stage of which he already knows the hidden workings. It will not arouse in him the foolish admiration of a giddy youth, but the discrimination of an exact and upright spirit. He may no doubt be deceived by his passions. Who is there who yields to his passions without being led astray by them? At least he will not be deceived by the passions of other people. If he sees them, he will regard them with the eye of the wise, and will neither be led away by their example nor seduced by their prejudices. As there is a fitting age for the study of the sciences, so there is a fitting age for the study of the ways of the world. Those who learn these too soon follow them throughout life without choice or consideration, and although they follow them fairly well, they never really know what they are about. But he who studies the ways of the world and sees the reason for them follows them with more insight, and therefore more exactly and gracefully. Give me a child of 12 who knows nothing at all. At 15 I will restore him to you, knowing as much as those who have been under instruction from infancy, with this difference, that your scholars only know things by heart, while mine knows how to use his knowledge. In the same way, plunge a young man of 20 into society under good guidance. In a year's time, he will be more charming and more truly polite than one brought up in society from childhood. For the former is able to perceive the reasons for all the proceedings related to age, position, and sex, on which the customs of society depend, and can reduce them to general principles and apply them to unforeseen emergencies, while the latter, who is guided solely by habit, is at a loss when habit fails him. Young French ladies are all brought up in convents till they are married. Do they seem to find any difficulty in acquiring the ways which are so new to them? And is it possible to accuse the ladies of Paris of awkward and embarrassing manners, or of ignorance of the ways of society, because they have not acquired them in infancy? This is the prejudice of men of the world, who know nothing of more importance than this trifling science, and wrongly imagine that you cannot begin to acquire it too soon. On the other hand, it is quite true that we must not wait too long. Anyone who has spent the whole of his youth far from the great world is all his life long awkward, constrained, out of place. His manners may be heavy and clumsy. No amount of practice will get rid of this, and he will only make himself more ridiculous by trying to do so. There is a time for every kind of teaching, and we ought to recognize it, and each has its own dangers to be avoided. At this age there are more dangers than at any other. I do not expose my pupil to them without safeguards. When my method succeeds completely in attaining one object, and when in avoiding one difficulty it also provides against another, I then consider it a good method, and that I am on the right track. This seems to be the case with regard to the expedient suggested by me in the present case. If I desire to be stern and cold towards my pupil, I shall lose his confidence, and he will soon conceal himself from me. If I wish to be easy and complacent, to shut my eyes, what good does it do him to be under my care? I only give my authority to his excesses and relieve his conscience at the expense of my own. If I introduce him into society with no object but to teach him, he will learn more than I want. If I keep him apart from society, what will he have learnt from me? Everything, perhaps, except the one art absolutely necessary to a civilized man, the art of living among his fellow men. If I try to attend to this at a distance, it will be of no avail. He is only concerned with the present. If I am content to supply him with amusement, he will acquire habits of luxury and will learn nothing. We will have none of this. My plan provides for everything. Your heart, I say to the young man, requires a companion. Let us go in search of a fitting one. Perhaps we shall not easily find such a one. True worth is always rare. but we will be in no hurry, nor will we be easily discouraged. No doubt there is such a one, and we shall find her at last, or at least we shall find someone like her. With an end so attractive to himself, I introduce him into society. What more need I say? Have I not achieved my purpose? By describing to him his future mistress, you may imagine whether I shall gain a hearing, whether I shall succeed in making the qualities he ought to love pleasing and dear to him, whether I shall sway his feelings to seek or shun what is good or bad for him. I shall be the stupidest of men if I fail to make him in love with he knows not whom. No matter that the person I describe is imaginary, it is enough to disgust him with those who might have attracted him. It is enough if it is continually suggesting comparisons which make him prefer his fancy to the real people he sees. And is not love itself a fancy, a falsehood, an illusion? We are far more in love with our own fancy than with the object of it. If we saw the object of our affections as it is, there would be no such thing as love. When we cease to love, the person we used to love remains unchanged, but we no longer see with the same eyes. The magic veil is drawn aside, and love disappears. But when I supply the object of imagination, I have control over comparisons, and I am able easily to prevent illusion with regard to realities. End of section 32.